Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Warm welcome to the show. Bill Arnold here. Thank you so much for joining me today. Awfully glad you decided to tune in. If you are just tuning in for the first time or the second time or the third time, or maybe you're just getting to know us, awfully glad you come back. And let us send you a welcome packet. If you don't know much about the station, we'd love for you to go to myfaithradio.com and just check. I would like a welcome packet, and we'll send you out all this cool stuff. Has all the information on the station and the shows and the personalities and the people like myself who would love to get to know you, and that would be great. So I have to say, I laughed out loud when I saw this story. This is a story of a guy who decided that he was going to rob a bank in Bayonne, which is in New Jersey. And he goes in there, hands the teller a note, demanding cash. Then he gets cold feet. Wants the note back, then he wants to just open up an account. Oh, you got to love this guy. This is my kind of guy, you know. Hand me the note back. I'm not going to rob the bank. I would now like to open up a checking account, preferably a high-yield one. And do I get to choose between the stadium blanket or the toaster? Which one? We have a great hour coming up. Just so you know, Rob Bluey, the editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal, is going to be with us in just a minute. And then Chris Mullis is going to be with us as well in the second half of the hour, talking about abuse, domestic abuse in the church. That's what's all ahead for the next hour. Awfully good you join me. I want to leave you with a passage of Scripture before we go to break. And, of course, one of my favorites is John 1, verses 12 to 13. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, children born not of natural descent nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. We'll take a break and be back with Rob Bluey in just a minute.
Have you ever wished you could listen to your favorite radio program when you wanted to? That way you'd never miss a program you really wanted to hear, simply because your program came on when you had an appointment, you were at work, or something urgent came up. And for those really busy days, you could listen early in the morning or late at night when things were calmer, and you could take the time to reflect and meditate on what you heard. Well, you can listen to your favorite programs whenever you want. Download the Faith Radio app by searching Faith Radio in the Apple Store or Google Play Store to gain instant access to Faith Radio programs and previous shows. It really is that simple. Search and subscribe to your favorite program and listen anytime. Download the Faith Radio app today and don't miss a thing. Once again, go to iTunes or Google Play on your mobile device and search for Faith Radio to download the free Faith Radio app and start listening today.
Welcome back to the show. You know, every day here at Faith Radio, I find out exactly what the listeners want, and then I give it to them. And I find out it's Rob Bluey. He's editor-in-chief at the Daily Signal, and he's with us today, my Washington, D.C. correspondent. Hello, Rob.
Hello. It's good to be with you, Bill.
Nice to be with you, as always. All right, let's jump into some of the tidbits here I have to discuss with you. The first one is about the Trump-backed tariffs. Now, I'm hearing that they're hurting soybean farmers in Iowa.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, the tariffs are hurting a lot of people, Bill, and this is one of the things that I think, you know, some of us free traders, conservatives, are scratching our head, because you have a president here who has done tremendous things to boost the economy through tax cuts and deregulations, and then when it comes to tariffs, it really, you know, challenges some of that logic and also creates some tough circumstances. So soybean farmers are one example, and you have the administration now saying that it's going to try to help some of the farmers by giving some government subsidies to them, which is just backwards. I mean,
yeah.
Why impose the tariffs in the first place? You wouldn't need to.
I don't get it. Well, let's talk about a little bit about the tariffs. What are the pros and cons, and what are they?
Well, let's start with what President Trump says. So
okay.
President Trump has long been somebody who has talked about the need for fair trade. He sees that the free trade argument that conservatives have traditionally made in the past has not benefited Americans in the way that, in his eyes, he thinks Americans have lost jobs, other countries are taking advantage of the United States, we have a huge trade deficit. On the other side of the equation, however, you have a situation where people say if you reduce the trade barriers, if you eliminate the tariffs, then you'll actually create a situation where there will be more people prospering, because you'll have people in both foreign countries, whether it's Europe and China and here in the United States, benefiting from the exchange of goods and services. So really one of those things where you'd like to get to the point where there's zero tariffs, and which is why I think there were so many people who were encouraged by the conversation and meeting that the president had last week with the European Union president, where they said that they wanted to get to the point where there were no tariffs from either side of the Atlantic Ocean.
But Rob, you hear about these trade deals in any reasonable person would go, these aren't fair.
Well, that's a good point, Bill. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who are being hurt. But I think there's a lot more than trade that is factoring into the equation. Obviously, our society is going through a massive change in the way that we approach work, whether it's through automation and the technology that is transforming how people do their jobs. The growth of robots, for instance. I mean, there is a whole number of factors that have impacted. It's not just trade. And then you have situations where I don't necessarily think the American people fully understand some of the benefits. And I think that's probably part of the fault of people who believe in free trade haven't done an effective job of selling them. So when communities are disrupted and people are put out of work, it's easy to point your finger at a foreign country is taking the jobs away because of trade, when in fact, there are probably a number of other factors. But I don't think the products that we buy in the store, I mean, you just saw, for instance, Coke is going to raise its prices on soda because of tariffs. I mean, there's a number of situations you're going to have to pay more for beer because, aluminum cans are now going to cost more because of tariffs. So I think the American people are just going to start to realize how impactful some of these tariffs are going to be. And once they start to do that, they're going to start to raise some questions and begin to wonder if necessarily this is the best approach that we should be taking. Now, Bill, let's face it. The other thing that we have to factor into this equation is the deal maker in President Trump. He is somebody who loves to negotiate, and this could be a tactic that he's using to try to get to these other countries to lower their tariffs. So we do get to a point where maybe that we're not in a trade war, but we're actually competing on a level playing field.
Well, Rob, speaking of trade war and opposition to the president's trade war, the Koch brothers have weighed in, and they're pretty upset.
Oh, you're absolutely correct about that. I mean, this is an area where the president has taken aim at the Koch brothers in a tweet. The Koch brothers first coming out after the president saying that there was a lack of leadership in Washington and they did not like the direction things were heading on some of the policy issues that they care about. Really, just one Koch, Charles Koch. We should acknowledge that the other brother has some health issues and has stepped aside from a lot of the political and policy debates at the current time. But this is notable because this is an organization, the Koch Network, which has provided a massive amount of money and support to conservative causes and in some cases candidates running for office. And so now that there appears to be some division and a willingness on the part of Charles Koch to work with Democrats on issues where they align, I think you could start to see some interesting alliances. Particularly if the president is going to take a tough tact with them and basically say that they're not going to cooperate in the ways that they may have in the past.
Mm-hmm. Rob, what do you think about Attorney General Jeff Sessions announcing a task force on religious liberty?
Well, it's a welcome development, and it's an issue that that is certainly front and center here in Washington after a lot of focus last week on international religious freedom. The Attorney General had an event yesterday featuring some people very familiar to us at both the Daily Signal and the Heritage Foundation, because we've covered many of these stories. And it's really surprising, Bill, in this day and age, to see how many people are still struggling with their rights to religious liberty that they are. And it comes in a number of forms. It comes in people who have conscience rights and are just trying to go about living their daily life or operate their business. It it comes down to things like adoption services and Christian adoption services that are no longer able to operate the way they once did in providing a home for children in need because of LGBT concerns and other things that have come up. So the fact that the Attorney General is taking this seriously and looking back at the constitutionality of this, I think, is a welcome development.
Hey, have you been to some of these events personally, Rob?
I did not go yesterday to the Attorney General's speech, but okay. A colleague of mine was certainly there, and we've covered it on the Daily Signal. I did get to interview the Attorney General last week, though.
Nice.
It was after you and I spoke for our weekly segment, and we talked about free speech, not specifically religious liberty, but certainly a topic that's very closely related. And I do know it's something I can tell you, Bill, that it's near and dear to his heart. I think he's seen it up close and personal. Some of the challenging situations that we're facing across this country. And as he looks out, particularly at college campuses, and he sees this lack of tolerance for debate and discussion, it's very concerning, the fact that you have bias committees now being set up at these colleges, which, you know, are they really intent on cracking down on bias, or are they really overarching and trying to cut down on speech like conservative points of view or Christian points of view that others on the campus might not really truly respect and want to give a platform to.
Mm-hmm. Rob, did the Attorney General ask if he could take a selfie with you?
He did not, but I we did get a picture, but it wasn't a selfie variety.
All right, Rob Bluey is my guest. He's editor of the Daily Signal. We'll take a little break. We come back. Lots more with Rob Bluey in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I have Rob Bluey on our studio line. We talk to Rob every week. He is editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. And go to dailysignal.com for all the updates and all the articles that we talk about are all there. You can go read all about them. Rob, let's start off talking about the rise of socialism and this new candidate. Tell me her name again.
Yeah, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez out of New York City.
Ocasio-Cortez. Yeah, I was having a brain freeze trying to come up with her name because I've seen her obviously many times. I was watching her sort of roll out her plan, and I'm thinking, who's going to pay for that? Anybody?
Well, this is the question we confront about socialism, right? That famous Margaret Thatcher quote about, it seems like an idea that works on paper until you actually try to figure out how to pay for it. And it's one of those things that has come up repeatedly. I mean, we just saw a new study come out from the Mercatus Institute looking at Medicare for All, which is another plank of this platform, and it's going to cost over $30 trillion. I mean, to put that in perspective, I think the federal budget is somewhere in the $4 trillion range. So, I mean, there's no way, at least how we're currently organized, we could ever afford to do some of these things. Advocating for the carbon tax, for instance, free college and education for all. I mean, the ideas here sound great. If you don't have a concern about actually making them reality, we have enough trouble funding our own military to protect us. And so to try to take care of some of these other challenges that they're pointing out here, I think that there are some consequences that our country would suffer if we were to go down that route. But you know what? It's attracted the attention of a lot of people, and that's why she and others are getting so much attention right now.
Well, doesn't the word free attract a lot of people?
Oh, it absolutely does.
Who doesn't
like
free?
That's why when you start to ask the questions about not only how are you going to pay for it, but give me a cost estimate for this. And that was one of the notable things about Bernie Sanders when this Medicare for All study came out from Mercatus, which put this high price tag on it. Bernie Sanders said that they didn't even do a cost analysis of the plan. So, I mean, you'd have to wonder how seriously they actually take these ideas if they're not even willing to go and do the homework to figure out how to go about implementing.
Yeah. Now, the Trump administration is trying to strengthen the military. Cortez's idea would be to reduce the military.
Well, she says that the military has more than it's even asking for. That's simply not true. And you have a situation where for 8 years under President Obama, there were many cutbacks and changes and not the strategic planning done that needed to be executed. So what they're doing now is they're trying to take a step back and look at some of the challenges. In fact, one of the things that President Trump recently announced was the formation of a space corps, because Russia and China have already moved aggressively into this area for the past 3 years. So the fact that the United States in some ways is playing catch-up when it comes to space, if we were to have a confrontation with any of these major actors or even, you know, medium-sized actors, I think that we'd be in a situation where we'd find ourselves a little bit outdated. I mean, Bill, think about it. We can't even put a man in space right now because we've retired the space shuttle program. So that's just one facet of where we're going in the future and what we need to be anticipating in the future of protecting our country. But there are a number of other challenges that the military faces. And when you think about the military force in and of itself and what a small percentage of the American population it is, we really need to be grateful for what they're doing this day to keep us safe.
Mm-hmm. All right, speaking of progressive socialism, what is going on in Nicaragua? That's a crisis going on.
It certainly is, yeah. President Ortega, or Dictator Ortega, we should say, created quite a constitutional problem there. I mean, in terms of exercising his power, installing his wife as vice president, and I think what you're starting to see is the opposition recognizing that this is not the life that they can have a much better life, basically, and they are creating challenges in Nicaragua. Another example, though, of why socialism doesn't work. I mean, you have Venezuela. I mean, you have so many examples that we can point to in our current day and age of where these countries have failed by trying to pursue these radical left-wing policies, and Nicaragua appears to be the latest example of that.
Okay, it's not an easy word to say, is it?
It's not. You got me tongue-tied at least a couple of times.
All right. Now, they're also violently attacking the Catholic Church there as well, aren't they?
That's right. That is right. This is just a remarkable story. And in fact, one of my colleagues, Ana Quintana, who's an expert on that region, just met with the priest who was in Washington, D.C. last week for some of the work that was being done by the State Department on religious liberty. And you're absolutely correct that the state militia went after the church and fired on the church for a number of hours. And I believe a couple of people unfortunately lost their lives. The priest was able to survive. But the fact that you have people taking sanctuary in a place of worship like this under heavy gunfire is just a troubling situation. And I think it goes to show that, in a situation like that, people are very desperate for a better solution and willing to risk it all if they can challenge the status quo and try to install, hopefully, a better solution for the government there.
Mm-hmm. All right, Rob, Groundhog Day. Are we going to have another shutdown over border security?
Well, it certainly appears that way.
Yeah.
I mean,
what are we going to do?
Things, time and time again. Well, here's the debate in Washington right now is whether or not this will happen before the election or if it'll happen after the election.
Uh-huh.
President Trump has been vague about this in his tweets, and it's created some uncertainty on Capitol Hill, where you have some of the leadership staff who aren't too keen on doing this before Election Day because they worry it's probably going to negatively impact Republicans. But then you have others who say, bring it on. You know, this is one of those things that Chuck Schumer decided to shut down the government for earlier this year, and polls consistently showed that it was actually helping Republicans because they wanted to get to a solution on immigration. They were tired of all the talk in Washington and the lack of action, and I think President Trump has spelled out his demands pretty clearly. I mean, he did so in the campaign. He wants a border wall. He wants to crack down on sanctuary cities. He wants more enforcement on the border, and you know, the big question here, Bill, is whether or not they can get to some sort of an agreement where the Democrats may get amnesty for a certain number of DACA recipients and some of these other measures are put in place. My wager here is that they'll probably end up passing some short-term spending bill, and they'll take this up after the election because I just know the way Republicans operate, and they're probably not going to want to have this fight.
Mm-hmm. Rob, when do you think the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings will begin?
It seems that they might still happen in August, although I think each passing day where we don't have more documents for senators to review. Now, he did make two important news developments yesterday. He met with Senator Joe Manchin. He's the first Democrat that he met with. That was an important step because up until now, Democrats had been unwilling to meet with him. And Senator Rand Paul, who was undecided, came out in favor of him, meaning that there's basically only two Republicans now who have not spoken in favor, and that's Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski in Alaska. And they probably will not state their position until the hearings happen. So I'd say the hearings will either happen the last week of August or maybe that first week of September. And if that were to happen, Bill, the important thing is he would still be on track if he passes out of committee after that hearing to be on the court by the October 1st start date.
Mm-hmm. Are you excited about Brett Kavanaugh?
Yeah, I think a lot of I personally am, and I think a lot of conservatives are. I mean, there was some polling done this week that showed I think upwards of 90% of Republicans want to see him confirmed. And in the key states where you have Democrat senators who voted for Neil Gorsuch, that would be West Virginia, North Dakota, and Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Those three Democratic senators voted for Gorsuch. There's a majority that supports Kavanaugh's confirmation, and even more importantly, there's an independent sector of voters who want to see him confirmed. So it's going to be hard for those Democratic senators to resist.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rob, it seems like Facebook and Twitter have been taking hits lately. Now, Twitter is denying this shadow banning. Would you explain to my listeners what that is and what they're doing?
Yes. So shadow banning is a term that you've heard some Republican congressmen use in the past week, because when you type in their name into the search box on Twitter, nothing comes up. So essentially there's a shadow there.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing you can see. And so these congressmen, Matt Gaetz, Devin Nunes, Mark Meadows, Jim Jordan, names that your listeners probably will recognize. For one reason or another, the Twitter algorithm was hiding them. Twitter says this was not done because of their political beliefs. It was done because of other factors on the platform. You know, this is, again, we're taking Twitter's word for it here. But it's just another example of where I think conservatives point to a bias and a certain level of suppression on these platforms. And, of course, Facebook's back in the news again today, making several high-profile purge of 32 pages from its platform that says that they were carrying out inappropriate behavior. So it seems like we can't go a day without the social media networks, at least recently, making some big waves. And conservatives have, I think, you know, good reason to be concerned. And this is one of the reasons they always need to be vigilant and hopefully paying attention to what they're doing on the platform. And it's why, you know, we at the Daily Signal believe that you can't rely on any one of these places to get your message out. And that's why we're so grateful to do this call, Bill, because, I mean, it's important to talk on radio just as it is on social media.
Yeah. So, Rob, what are you predicting in terms of the midterms? What is talk in your town on midterms?
Well, the talk is that we're still 3 months out, so
okay.
There's a lot that can happen in politics in that time. And as of right now, there are certainly a high number of Republican vacancies, people who are retiring or resigning, not coming back to Washington. And any time you have a situation like that, I think that by last count there were 42 of those seats in the House. That is a high number. I think it's the highest number since the 1930s. So what that does is that creates a situation where you have an open field, and you have two newcomers in many cases who are vying for a seat. And depending on the mood of voters, you could have some changes coming our way in January of 2019. We shall see.
Mm-hmm. Rob, we still have about a minute left. Any other tidbits that are going underreported that you want to mention?
Yeah, I will. I think one of the most exciting stories that we're working on of late is telling the story about tax reform. I know we covered this last week. We went out and we interviewed a local business owner who Jamison Door Company. They have a facility here in Maryland on the D.C. suburbs, as well as one in New Mexico. And Bill, I'll tell you, hearing the stories of how these workers have been able to benefit with the extra money that they have in their paychecks is truly remarkable. Just to remind you of the numbers, a family of four over a 10-year period will have $44,000 extra thanks to tax reform. And I don't think that we tell those stories well enough.
Yeah.
Finding the individuals and what they're doing with the extra money, whether it means maybe finally taking a vacation with their family. So it's those stories that we think go underreported, and we're trying to make sure we tell. Bill, if I could just do for a second here, if your listeners have stories that they think we should be telling, I mean, you should go to dailysignal.com or send me an email. You can reach us at letters@dailysignal.com. I mean, we'd love to hear those stories and make sure that we're featuring them on the Daily Signal.
That's awesome, Rob. Thank you so much, editor of the Daily Signal. Go to dailysignal.com to check out all of the writings. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute.
Do you want to make a positive difference for Jesus Christ? If so, where do you begin? Hi, I'm Steve Douglas for Making Your Life Count. And Amelia Rhodes says her neighborhood was a great starting point.
I asked God to help me be more faithful in praying for my friends and my family and the community around me. And at that point, I had this idea of praying A to Z, because I recognize so many people struggle with the same things. Like, how many people do we know that are going through cancer? How many people do we know that are struggling with depression? How many people do we know whose marriages are struggling? Or even if their marriages aren't struggling, they could just use that extra support. And I started praying, A, adoptions, B, bullying, and praying for the teachers in the school. And it was a way to just focus on one topic a day and remember all of the people that I knew that were struggling with those particular things.
Prayer is transformational. It transforms you, and it transforms those around you.
What's not to love about that, Rob Bluey? Love him. So glad you're with me today. Bill Arnold here. Chris Moles is a pastor and speaker and biblical counselor, and he's written a book called The Heart of Domestic Abuse, Gospel Solutions for Men Who Use Violence and Control in the Home. And my brother-in-law, Tom, said, you've got to get a hold of Chris Moles. And I always listen to Tom, so I do what he says. So we got a hold of Chris Moles, and here he is today. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Bill, thanks for having me.
You bet.
And thanks to Tom.
Yeah, you really should not thank me. Thank Tom, because it was Tom's idea to have you. Yeah. So
be sure to tell Tom thanks.
Yeah, and my sister's listening, so she'll probably tell Tom for me. So we've got that all figured out. Cool. All right, Chris, you know, this is such a huge issue, and it's coming up in the news every day. Violence against women, and it's the narrative that we hear every day in the news. And we're trying to do something about it, but even more so in the church, when you hear about domestic abuse, nobody knows how to talk about this or deal with it.
Yeah, I would say you're onto something, and not just within the church. I would say within the culture, we have a massive deficit of even acknowledging the extent of the problem. I mean, it's believed that 1 in 4 women will suffer at the hands of an intimate partner in their lifetime. And then with regards to that, Bill, there's no discernible difference inside the church and outside the church. So a huge problem. I mean, domestic violence affects the health of women more than car accidents, rapes, and muggings combined. And so it's a massive problem that's kind of hidden in the cultural milieu or the atmosphere of our culture today.
Chris, what are churches doing about this? What is being done?
Well, there's very little that the church has been doing, unfortunately. I think within the church, it's really been a holy hush about the significance of the problem. And in many cases, most churches were just not really equipped to handle the problem. And one key example of that is that churches are really effective at marriage counseling, and we really value marriage counseling. But within domestic violence, most experts agree marriage counseling is impotent at best and dangerous at worst because of the coercive nature mm-hmm. of the problem. And so often churches apply what we know and inadvertently do more damage than we do good. That's why education is a big part of our ministry. And I think even as you're seeing movement within our brothers and sisters in the Southern Baptists, a key issue is education, learning about the problem and then applying biblical gospel-centered solutions to the problem.
Mm-hmm. Chris, let me just get to know you a little bit. How did you get into this area of ministry?
Yeah, so I'm a pastor vocationally. My degrees are in Bible and theology and counseling. And really, it was just in a moment of wanting and praying to be involved in ministry. I pastor very small churches, have never really been in a large ministry setting, and God provided opportunities through criminal corrections. I began working part-time teaching parenting classes and being an educator within our criminal justice system. And within a few years of that, I was invited to be part of what's called a batterer intervention program, which is a group in which men are sentenced to our class as part of their probation if they've been convicted of a domestic violence crime or they've been issued a civil protection order against them. Well, that really was the beginning stages about 12 years ago. And, you know, since then, Bill, I've just kind of combined my experience in biblical counseling and my experience within the criminal justice system to attempt to educate the church from what I've learned from the world and then what I think is the truth from the scripture to really give us a little bit more detail on the problem and God's solutions.
Yeah. Chris, I'm so interested to get some of your wisdom on addressing the hearts of men.
Yeah, so, you know, when I say that phrase, there's two sides to that coin. Probably the first and most influential side to that is really the violence against women is at such epidemic proportions in our world today. The the real hope, or I should say the real force that could bring about change, are men in general. So the first group of men where we want to address their heart, I think, are the everyday, average, good, decent men, in particular Christian men, who've been silent. It's estimated that 20 to 25% of men commit these acts of abuse against their partners. So that leaves 75 or 80% of us who are not. But I think we would all agree that it's been a relatively silent topic in the church. And so the first group of men I would love to encourage are men who are not participating in these behaviors, to speak up, to fight against abuse, to support and love their sisters. And then the second group of men are abusive people. I do believe in the hope of the gospel. I think that an abusive man's only real hope is the transformative power of the Spirit. And I think the church is a positioned very well to be a source of accountability for men who use who have used control and abuse in the home, and we should call them to repentance. Mm-hmm. And if they don't repent, then we should be eager to discipline men who are continuing to sin in such a way.
Yeah, I know, Chris, this is such a sensitive subject, so I know my listeners will want to further understand what is meant by acts of abuse.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So this is one of those things where I think the church has a long way to go, Bill, and we could do such a better job if we would kind of take our guard down a little bit. And one of the things that I mean by that is the church is one of the places where I encounter some hostility on defining domestic abuse. I define domestic abuse first as an abuse of power. I think the issue behind domestic abuse and domestic violence is really the use of power to control another person. The idea here, biblically speaking, is oppression. And so what we're really dealing with is not one singular instance of violence where someone was hit or someone was slapped. What we're talking about when we're talking about abuse is a pattern of coercive control. And that requires a level of power. That's why men are, by and large, the greatest perpetrators of abuse, is because we tend to have power both physically through the creative order and then also societally. So that's the first issue. It's manifested through selfishly motivated patterns of behavior. Abuse is always a pattern. It's rarely an incident. Even though legally speaking, you can commit an act of violence, domestic abuse is really seen in patterns. That's why you're usually talking about months or years of abuse as opposed to one incident of abuse. And then the goal is almost always the same, and that's to gain control. So there's a great deal of pride, great deal of entitlement, and abuse of power, and then the end result is to control. Anything that falls into those categories can then become abusive. So that's why I kind of shy away from, here's what emotional abuse looks like, here's what financial abuse looks like, but instead saying, if we're looking at this pattern of coercive control, and certainly finances can be a part of that. Certainly name-calling is part of that. And absolutely physicality is part of that. But so is isolation and minimization and denial and lies. All of that can seep in because the end result's the same. A person in power wants to control another person, and they'll use coercion and force to do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand it's predominantly men that are the perpetrators, and I get that. And you've done a nice job of explaining it, Chris, that it's kind of a combination of physicality and also words. And I think that's where it gets a little tricky when it gets to words and emotional abuse and who defines it and who gets to decide, you know, would an outside group or a counselor say that's clearly abuse and so now something needs to be done? Or how do we get people to the table?
Yeah. So one of the things that I would suggest, and I should probably give a caveat right off the bat. So I'm part of a theological construct, a theological framework known as complementarity. So I'm one of the rare advocates in the work that believes that men and women were created differently and we function in marriage in different roles. I actually think that gives me a little bit more leverage, biblically speaking, because it's in that construct that I say with, you know, the Spider-Man principle, with great power comes great responsibility, that men are created bigger, faster, stronger. They've been given a level of power, so they're most likely to abuse it. when I get some pushback on that, you know, that would say, well, women can be emotionally abusive, I would not disagree. However, I would say I think there is a large difference between what we deal with when it comes to domestic abuse and domestic violence and individuals who are manipulative. And what I mean by that is I could say and do certain things to my wife that would terrify her because of my stature and my position. And if she were to do those same things to me, it wouldn't terrify me.
Mm-hmm.
I would still have the same amount of freedom. I would just probably be annoyed
mm-hmm.
or angry.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean it's any less sinful.
Right.
It doesn't mean that it's right. It just means that when I push up against a wife in particular who uses certain tactics, it may be sinful, but I don't always categorize it as abusive because that power dynamic is so significant, which is why women, their acts of abuse are much more likely to occur against children than against a husband or a partner.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Chris Moles. We're talking about domestic abuse, and I don't have to be the one asking all the questions. You can send me a text at 877-933-2484. Again, that number is 877-933-2484, and I'll get your question on the air to Chris. Chris, as we talk about the perpetrators, the abusers, what do you understand to be the heart issues at play?
Yeah, you know, theologically speaking, I really think that the greatest issue at play is pride. I tend to say that all violent people are prideful, even though all prideful people are not violent.
Mm-hmm.
There is within an individual who's willing to abuse power, there is almost always a sense of entitlement. If you take just a cursory look, say, at the Old Testament, some of the Old Testament narratives, you see this in, say, the heart of Nebuchadnezzar when he declares himself to be great on his porch as he overlooks his kingdom. And you certainly see that reflected in his oppression. I think you see it in 1 Samuel when David neglects his responsibilities as king, remains in Jerusalem, and then ends up, I believe, assaulting Bathsheba by using his power to control and then ultimately murdering Uriah. So you see how pride and entitlement flows in the heart of these people with power. I think in a very similar way, that lies at the heart of coercive and controlling men, a certain level of entitlement, which is one of the things that churches have to speak into, Bill, because many of the men in our churches are coming away with, a carnival mirror version of Christian family, where they come away with a distorted vision of headship that ends up being what my friend Jason calls hyper-headship, which is a satanic distortion of Christ-like leadership. And it can easily twist and morph. So instead of being a servant leader, we can find Christian men or men who claim to be Christian using oppressive tactics.
My brother-in-law Tom was right. Chris, you're an interesting man. Let me take a little break. ChrisMoles.org is his website. If you have a question about domestic violence in the church or otherwise, you can give us a text message at 877-933-2484. Otherwise, after a short break, we will return with Chris Moles. Be back in a minute. We were not gone too long. Chris Moles is my guest on our studio line. He's written a book called The Heart of Domestic Abuse, Gospel Solutions for Men Who Use Violence and Control in the Home. Chris, again, let me just state, this is a very difficult subject, and you handle this with such deftness. So I appreciate your research on this and your wisdom. Let's talk a little bit about the biblical understanding of submission, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. Sure, I actually just completed a podcast on this from the perspective of 1 Peter 3. I have a podcast called the Peaceworks Podcast, and we just talked about some of the ways in which the church has taken, and I don't mean to just completely throw the church under the bus. I love the church. I am the church, right? But I think, unfortunately, we have taken a line in the sand that just was not meant to be there. And we have really wanted submission so badly that I think we've settled for subjugation. And we have longed for headship so badly that we've settled, in some cases, for oppression. And so I believe if you read the major passages in the New Testament, 1 Peter 3 being one, Ephesians 5, Colossians 3, and you read them in context, you'll find that submission is a beautiful reality, but not strict obedience. And I think that's been one of the heartbreaking things, Bill, is as I've worked with victims and then I've worked with perpetrators and then even with pastors, there has been a sense that headship and submission has been really reduced from its richness, from servant leadership and respect to really blind obedience that wives are expected to dress the way their husband wants them to dress or to use finances a strict way or to be home at a certain time under strict rules as if their husband is their father and they're a child. And there's just really nothing in the passage, especially in Ephesians 5, when you start with verse 1 of chapter 5, be imitators of God, therefore, it really sets the tone that our first response is our identity in Christ as imitators of God. And then, of course, verse 21, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And so Paul is unpacking what mutual submission looks like in the context of three specific relationships. And I just have a hard time seeing strict obedience in there and lordship as far as lording over as opposed to headship as Christ-like servant leadership. So that would be my very brief pushback. And I think we have a lot to learn in this area. Certainly I'm not the last word, but women who are suffering and relationships that are oppressive and subjugation instead of submission is a real, real problem. So I think we could at least start there.
Well, churches are looking at this with different eyes today, aren't they, Chris? Because, I mean, I know stories of women that dealt with abuse. They went to the elders, and the elders kind of ignored them more or less.
I would say, Bill, and I, again, said from a place of love, I think there is a sleeping giant that's beginning to flicker his eyelids. I think the church, she's beginning to wake up and will be, I honestly believe, will be the greatest force in providing safety for women and holding perpetrators accountable. And I think that's going to happen in the next 20 years. But for me, what I have seen, which has been so sad, is our victims who have pleaded with their elders, have pleaded with their leadership, have tried to rally support, and the church has continued to throw marriage-focused solutions at a heart problem. And after years of interventions that were missing the mark, victims finally get up, give up, file for divorce, and then the church disciplines the victim for filing for divorce,
ouch,
and the perpetrator's never held accountable.
Ouch.
This is such a reoccurring story that I don't say it with any pleasure, and I don't say it, you know, that I, like I've heard one instance. I'm talking over and over, like a record on repeat. This has been the story. Thank God we're seeing changes in that, and we're seeing godly leaders step up and apologize, seek forgiveness, look for restoration of relationships that they've broken because of primarily ignorance. And that's why I think education and conversations like this are so important to get the ball rolling so we can head this off so that there's no more misplaced discipline. In fact, discipline is used rightly for the conviction of sin. When it comes to the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm. Chris, let's talk about the difficulty of confrontation and when that should happen and what's a biblical understanding of confrontation and when should we do it, and help us with that, if you would.
Sure. What I would challenge to especially those in pastoral leadership or elder boards that might be listening is to really guard against creating policies that are formulamatic. One of the difficulties I've seen with churches is that we've, in some ways, engineered our responses rather than allowing wisdom and the Spirit of God to guide our responses. And what I mean by that is if you've seen one case of abuse, you've now seen one case of abuse. There are similarities, but there are so many distinct differences and complexities. To apply the same filter or the same rubric to every case would really be foolish, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true for confrontation. Even biblically speaking, how we confront and the ways in which we confront will be guided by wisdom and the severity of the problem. So Paul confronts the sinner in the Corinthian church who was committing immorality. very grievous immorality to the point that this person is to be kicked out of the church immediately. It was immediate excommunication. He calls Titus to warn a divisive person twice and then have nothing to do with them. And then, of course, the most common is Jesus' words in Matthew 18, confronting a brother. And I think all of those can be utilized under the wisdom of the church. So confrontation can happen rapidly, depending upon the severity of the sin. It can also happen over time. My one warning to churches using Matthew 18 is please don't bypass the victim. The most common failure of Matthew 18 is pastors will call me and say, okay, we believe he's abusive. We believe this is the problem. We're going to initiate step one of church discipline as if the wife has not already been confronting him. And if she's a believer in Christ, step one happened the moment she said, ow, the moment she said, stop. So we're engaging farther down the road than we give ourselves credit for, and we certainly need to be acknowledging that instead of bypassing our sisters.
Mm-hmm. Christy, if someone ends up at a domestic abuse group, like a support group or a something that they're going to for help, do they first talk about how much they're like a victim?
You know, it just depends upon the group. My training from an advocacy perspective, and every advocate that I've worked with has been trained to offer support. Advocacy 101 says we don't tell the victim what to do. And so I have, and honestly, you know, of all the victims I've been around, actual victims, people who've been harmed, and I'm not afraid to use the word victim because folks have really been victimized, I've rarely run into anybody who throws pity parties, if that makes sense. Most victims are quick to assume guilt. Most victims are quick to take responsibility, in large part because of the lies they've been told about who they are. And so much of your advocacy work is listening, supporting, and educating, because many victims, I've heard women say, well, it's not like I'm being abused because he never hit me, or he never hit me with his fist, or all of these qualifying things that education would help open eyes a little bit too. So, yeah, I really haven't seen a lot of the victimhood mentality that some of my peers have said is out there. And I think that's part of being in the work for a long time. You start to see the realities kind of hidden behind the veil of the caricature.
Chris, what is it like when you experience a relationship, with someone who comes into your counseling and shows up with this pride and obviously is involved in domestic abuse, and then they turn and they become healed or they start to develop humility? What is that like? It's got to be a beautiful thing.
In the life of a perpetrator, it's rare, and I think it's important to say how rare it is. Especially, as I like to say, the farther down the rabbit hole you go.
Mm-hmm.
So the more you've escalated violence, coercion, and control, the more difficult it is. Of course, nothing's impossible with God. I've seen the gospel really get a hold of some guys' hearts. One example comes to mind is a church I've worked several cases with over the years. And, you know, we've had some men who've become stiff-necked and obstinate. We've had some men who've repented. And then we've had a lot of men in between, right? And the repentance piece is beautiful, but in a way, so is the obstinate piece, Bill, because if a guy rejects the gospel and he remains stiff-necked and obstinate, then we know where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
We can quit pretending, we can quit glossing over it, and we can pursue the steps we need to pursue. But yeah, when repentance happens, and it's a real thing, it's beautiful. Now, my warning is it's not instantaneous. It's not that initial, I'm sorry, let's make everything normal again. It's long-term, observable repentance. Mm-hmm. I use Ephesians 4 as our model. When's a thief no longer a thief? Well, it's when he's known as a generous person.
Right.
When's an abuser no longer an abuser? It's when, over time, he's known as an encouraging, supportive, godly person.
Chris,
that's gotta take time and observation.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not done talking to you, so we're going to have to get you on the show again. This has been so interesting, so informative. I want to hear more about it, so we'll have you back. But thank you for being a guest. My brother-in-law, Tom, was right about all of this, so you've been a wonderful guest. ChrisMoles.org is his website. You can go check out what he's written and also check out his book, Reducing Violence Against Women, is really the whole heart of it. So, Chris, thank you so much. Have a great evening.
Hey, thank you, Bill. And thank you, Tom, wherever you are.
Of course. Thank you. All right. We'll take a short break and be back with hour two in just a minute. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.